We have a special visitor today, I just noticed, so I'm going to mention, I hope you'll be in Fellowship Hall after the service, and I'll do some introductions. But I know a lot of you know Martin Ratcliffe, who attends this church with his wife and his family. He's the, what's the definition, the British astronomer who, like all British astronomers in South Central Kansas, he operates the Cyberdome and runs that at Exploration Place. If you haven't seen that, there's, what, two of such amazing technological feats in the world, and one of them's in Wichita, Kansas. You should go see the Cyberdome. But Martin's good friend, Thomas Bopp, is here this morning. And Tom's claim to fame is he was the co-discoverer of the Hale-Bopp comet, which was one of the great celestial events of the 20th century. So I think they'll be in Fellowship Hall afterwards. I hope you'll let me introduce you. I spent last evening with the Ratcliffes and with Tom gazing through Martin's magnificent telescope at the heavens, which always leaves me feeling a little smaller and God seeming a little bigger. And maybe there's a plan, because I didn't know Tom would be here, and the sermon today is on Revelation, which has its share of falling stars. So, providence? Who knows? Anyway, this is the last week of this short series on Revelation, and we've already talked about how the book barely made it into the Bible in the first place, and how our Protestant forefathers chose to either ignore it, as in the case of John Calvin, or claim it should be thrown into a river. That was Martin Luther's suggestion for the book of Revelation. We talked about apocalyptic literature and how for the 300 years that style of writing was popular, the authors who wrote in that genre undoubtedly never dreamed people would one day insist on reading their imaginative, fanciful, and metaphorical language literally. And we concluded last week by making a quick overview of the entire book, which is actually a letter written to the seven churches of what is today Turkey, then called Asia, by a man of visions named John of Patmos. Today, we will examine the two ways of reading the Revelation of John, as a futuristic vision of things that are soon to happen, and as a symbolic story about the first century world in which the author lived. We'll begin with the results of some relatively recent polls. According to a 1980 Gallup poll, 2/3 of all Americans, not just Christians, mind you, but 2/3 of all Americans have, quote, no doubts that Jesus will come again. Another poll indicates that over 1/3 of all Americans believe the world will end soon. Now, make no mistake, the book of Revelation has been scaring people witless ever since it was included in the Christian Bible around 400 AD. But over the centuries, people viewed Revelation as a sort of scary and mysterious addendum to the Bible. It wasn't really until the 20th century that a literal reading of that book became the theological foundation for a part of the church. For this, we can pretty much thank a guy named Cyrus Scofield, who in 1909 published the Scofield Reference Bible. This abomination still adorns the bookshelf of every fire and brimstone, here comes the end of the world preacher in America. It was Scofield's theory that God had divided history into seven ages, which he called dispensations, and that the final age, when Christ physically comes again to rule on earth, precisely as described in Revelation, was about to happen. Scofield pored over the Bible and, in effect, turned it into a book of clues and riddles. All of Scripture was one big puzzle to be deciphered, with mysterious and secret meanings everywhere. And all those clues were a way of giving us a chance of escaping the coming wrath of God. Fortunately for us, for all of humanity, Cyrus Scofield appeared in the nick of time, and his reference Bible was the key which unlocked the truth hidden from past generations. Well, Scofield set the stage, and as you can tell by the amazing success of the Left Behind books by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, there has been no shortage of people willing to cash in on people's fears. The end of the world is big business. As I proceed with the two ways of thinking about the book of Revelation, I again want to give credit to Marcus Borg and his book, Reading the Bible Again for the First Time, for much of the information I will be passing on. I rely on Borg because I've found he has this rare way of cutting through the extraneous junk and getting right to the heart of the matter. The futurist interpretation of Revelation, that it is a book which accurately describes things that are soon to happen in this world, has three premises. One, what Revelation describes has not yet happened. Two, the Bible is, in all cases, literally true and cannot be wrong. And therefore, number three, all things described in Revelation must still be in the future. With these premises, Revelation becomes a puzzle, a cryptogram filled with clues and symbols about the signs that will precede the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. The height of this end of the world theorizing about the book of Revelation occurred in the 1970s when Hal Lindsey wrote a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Since that book was so popular, it was the best-selling nonfiction book in the entire decade of the 70s, we'll use his theories to illustrate a futurist interpretation of Revelation. Lindsey argues that the signs of the end times are all around us, and the biggest sign of all was the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. There are biblical passages that indicate the people of Israel will once again live in their own land as a nation when the time for the end of the world arrives, and that has been true only since 1948. So, Scofield says, Hal Lindsey says, the stage has been set. Lindsey then goes through and systematically decodes the language of Revelation and applies it to the world today. I'll give you some examples. This is from chapter 6 of Revelation. When he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and there came a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth, the moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth. The sky vanished like a scroll rolling itself up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. That passage, says Lindsey, describes a thermonuclear exchange. The stars of the sky falling to earth are orbiting nuclear bombs, re-entering the atmosphere. The sky rolling up like a scroll is a description of what happens to the atmosphere when a nuclear bomb is detonated. Again, hear these words from the ninth chapter of Revelation. Then the sixth angel blew his trumpet, and I heard a voice saying, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." So the four angels were released, who had been held ready for the hour, the day, the month, and the year to kill one-third of humankind. The number of the troops of cavalry was 200 million. Hal Lindsey figures this passage must surely be referring to communist China. Who else has a population large enough to field an army of 200 million? One more quote from Revelation, again from chapter 9. See if you can guess how Lindsey interprets this passage. Locusts appeared like horses equipped for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold. Their faces were like human faces. Their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lions' teeth. They had scales like iron breastplates, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails like scorpions with stingers, and in their tails is the power to harm people for 5 months. Well, tails like scorpions, noises like many chariots. Lindsey concludes that John of Patmos was given a vision of an attack helicopter. He doesn't bother to explain where it is on modern attack helicopters that one places a crown of gold and a human face let alone, quote, women's hair, not to mention the power to harm people for 5 months. Lindsay recognizes the importance of the ten-horned beast from the sea in Revelation 13, and he understands that it has something to do with Rome. He concludes that it refers to an updated Roman Empire consisting of a ten-nation confederacy. Obviously, this is the group known as the European Economic Community, a group formed by the Treaty of Rome and which had 10 members in the 1970s. In that passage, there is a horn that received a mortal wound but somehow recovers, and that, concludes Lindsay, is a future leader of the European Economic Community who will survive an assassination attempt and rise to rule the world. Lindsay claims this, quote, future Führer is alive now and was alive in the 70s, although the world has no idea who it is. Therefore, the time of the rapture, the final tribulation, the battle of Armageddon, the second coming of Christ, and the last judgment is near. Now, the rapture is the idea that true Christians will be taken up from earth and meet Jesus in the air, so they will be spared the great suffering that will arrive with the end times. The suffering is known as the tribulation and begins, according to Revelation, with the opening of the seven seals, the blowing of the seven trumpets, and the pouring out of the seven bowls, all of which unleashes God's awful wrath upon the world. The tribulation ends with the battle of Armageddon and the defeat of the beast's armies by the returning cosmic warrior, Jesus Christ. To read Revelation in this manner, this futurist interpretation, has some effects on the Christian message. Consider some of those effects. The gospel, or the good news, becomes the news that you can be saved from the awful wrath of our angry God by believing the right things about Jesus. The focus of the Christian faith becomes saving yourself and those you love from the horrendous, ugly fate that God has planned for almost all of humanity. And the implications for everyday life in this world are striking. Why worry about things like the environment and social justice if the world is about to end? Forget the world, get saved, hunker down, and wait. Most of us find Hal Lindsey's fantasizing about Revelation amusing, but we can't deny he has attracted millions and millions of followers. And the idea that Revelation is in some way foretelling future events is accepted by a wide range of Christians, including many who reject Lindsey's interpretation. They don't think the Revelation of John can be precisely decoded as it is in the late great planet Earth, but they do believe it speaks in vague and mysterious ways about the coming end of the world. The question, of course, is what alternative do we have to approaching the book as an actual foretelling of the end of the world? Whether that cataclysmic ending is coming next week or a million years in the future, must we believe that Revelation in some way tells us of things that are destined to happen in the future? We have another way of approaching the Revelation of John, namely by interpreting it as a reflection of the past, a symbolic history of the world the author lived in 2,000 years ago. The first thing we have to do when approaching the book from this perspective is to take seriously the fact that Revelation was a letter, and the letter was not written to 21st century Americans. It was written to seven specific churches in Asia. And this takes no leap of faith. John of Patmos says right off the bat, I'm writing this letter to the seven churches in Asia, and names those seven churches. And while there's no doubt that John is talking about the future, he is most certainly talking about the very near future. He describes the things he envisions as, quote, what must soon take place, and says his words must immediately be read aloud to the churches because, quote, the time is near. He concludes his letter by mentioning five times that the end is imminent. While it may be true, as some argue, that one day is like 1,000 years to God, it seems clear that the author of this book was writing about his own world's very immediate future. Let's look at some places within the body of the letter that reveal John was addressing the issues of his own time. In chapter 13, the 10-horned beast from the sea rules the world and demands worship. The Roman emperors ruled John's world. Those emperors demanded worship and had temples throughout the empire in which they were hailed as Lord and God. And as I told you last week, the much ballyhooed number 666, the number of the beast, the sign of the Antichrist, has kept prophets of doom on the lookout for the one who will rise to do battle against the forces of good. In John's world, the forces which were fighting against good, the forces which were persecuting the church, were the powers under the control of the Roman emperor. And using gematria, an ancient decoding technique, the number 666 translates Caesar Nero. And consider John's vision of the great whore in chapter 17, another symbolic reference to the Roman Empire. The woman, dressed in royal attire, rides upon the beast, and her name is Babylon the Great. This can be confusing because the Babylonian Empire vanished 600 years before John wrote this letter. But listen closely, because this is a key point to understanding Revelation. The religious world of the Jews, from which Christianity sprang and upon which Christianity is built, was centered on the temple. Solomon built the first temple in the 10th century BC, and Babylon, in 586 BC, destroyed the temple. This was the beginning of the Babylonian captivity, the greatest tragedy the people of God had ever faced up to that point. And then, after the Babylonian captivity, the temple was rebuilt, and it again stood as the house of God himself, the holiest place on earth, until 70 AD, just a few decades before John wrote this letter. And in 70 AD, a foreign army once again rode into Jerusalem and leveled the temple, this time for good. To this day, the temple has never been rebuilt. Who destroyed the temple for good? Surely one of the most pivotal moments in the life of the first century faithful, Rome. And in first century Christian and Jewish circles, Babylon had become the symbolic name for Rome. Some may think this is stretching the point a bit, claiming that John is referring to Rome when he says Babylon. And this is critical, because if what I'm saying is true, then all of John's imagery is aimed not at the rising evil powers in the modern world we live in, but solely at the Roman Empire of the first century. Well, consider this. The great whore, whose name is Babylon the Great, is seated on seven mountains. Throughout history, Rome has been known as the city built on seven hills. And then John does something he rarely does in this letter. He actually interprets the symbol for us. This is a quote from Revelation. "The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." That's Rome. When you take into consideration that the seven churches to which he addressed his letter would have found no meaning in predictions about the European Economic Community and attack helicopters, it becomes evident that John was writing about his own time. Further, there can be no doubt about the identity of the great enemy of God he rails against throughout the letter. That enemy is Rome. Remember, Christians were being fed to lions in Rome as a way of entertaining the masses. And there were occasions when Christians were covered with wax, tied to crosses along the way leading from the Colosseum, and then burned alive to provide lighting for those who were leaving the evening's entertainment. This happened. John and those first century churches didn't need to look thousands of years in the future to find the Antichrist. And John used the popular literary genre of apocalyptic literature to both warn and encourage the churches in his region. He certainly was writing about the future, predicting God's revenge against Rome. But he was writing about the immediate future of his world and not the immediate future of ours. Did John believe all the things he was writing would literally happen? That his visions were precise and accurate predictions of what would soon happen in his first century world? That can be argued both ways, and we'll never know for sure exactly how John perceived his visions. There is an underlying message in the revelation of John, however, that exists as the real purpose of the letter. Marcus Borg, to whom I am indebted for the content of this series on Revelation, summarizes John of Patmos's message as threefold. First, even though it doesn't seem that way, Christ is Lord. Caesar and the beast, the powers of evil, are not. Second, God will act to overthrow the rule of the beast and its incarnation in Caesar. And third, the churches should therefore have faith and persevere through the present evil. With that, I'm going to try to bring this short series on Revelation to a close. When I decided to put together some thoughts on Revelation, I knew there was no way I could even come close to doing the book justice with a single sermon. And as I mapped out my thoughts, I realized it was going to take 6 or 8 weeks to really do the book justice. I chose instead to do a quick overview, knowing that even then I couldn't possibly do it in a single sermon. I compromised on a 2-week series, not wanting to dwell on a single subject for too long and hoping I could cover the main points in that time. There is a lot we didn't cover. Many themes that lie between the lines of that mysterious and misunderstood letter, two of which I should at least mention. There is the theme of the cosmic battle between good and evil, which permeates Revelation, and which has endured from humanity's earliest creation myth, the Enuma Elish, through to the Jedi Knights and Darth Vader of Star Wars. And there is the theme of the two lordships, Jesus versus Caesar, which we barely touched on, and which has huge implications for the world we live in today as we try to balance ourselves between the demands of our faith and the seductions of our culture. I confess I tend to be one of those people who, like Martin Luther, wish somebody had just thrown the revelation of John into a river a long time ago. It's caused a lot of people a lot of problems, and as long as there are those intent on scaring others into the Christian faith and cashing in on their fears, it will continue to cause problems. But if we accept it for what it is, I think we have to admit it holds a powerful place in the Bible, largely because of the way it completes the symbolic story we find in Genesis, the first book of the Bible. The Bible begins with God's creation of the world and humanity's alienation from God. The Bible ends with the reunion of God and humanity with the overcoming of the exile from the Garden of Eden. Finally, God truly rules. Every tear shall be wiped away, and the river of life flows through humankind's new home, God's new and perfect creation. And there we will all see God and joyfully worship together forevermore. For all the problems we have with the book of Revelation, it's hard to imagine a more powerful ending to the Bible.